success. With each passing day that American planes bombed but did not kill any Taliban, not enough of them at least, the locals grew angry and dismissive of the Americans, who had been cowed in places like Vietnam and Somalia when dead and wounded U.S. soldiers began coming home. The town of Karshi Khanabad sat about 2 miles from the camp, on the other side of a 30-foot-high berm meant to keep the place secure from enemy attack. And there were enemy around. Terrorist cells of the IMU, the Islamic Militant Union, operating within the country in hopes of returning the former Soviet Republic to a fundamentalist state. The Americans were forbidden to go beyond the berm, or to fraternize with any of the local workers and suppliers who streamed in and out of the place in cargo vans. Fear of mortar attack loomed in the camp. In a matter of a few weeks, the air control tower had been swept and rewired, a hospital was built, and food, clothing, ammunition were cached in newly built warehouses, and the communications tents quickly sprouted bouquets of satellite antennas. In less than a month, 60 C-17 transport planes would offload several thousand tons of supplies. The place, in the words of one Army historian, looked like a gold rush boomtown. The entire cantonment was approximately a half mile long and a quarter mile wide. It took 5 minutes to walk down a dirt service road to reach the Chinook helicopters and the taxiway. Next to them sat the Blackhawks, the Chinook security escorts, bristling with rockets and door guns, and looking in the bronze light of morning and evening like an ancient army of insects rearing on ash-black legs. Colonel Mulholland's Joint Operations Center, or JOC, pronounced Jock, consisted of 20 tents made of heavy green vinyl, each about the size of a two-car garage, and joined end-to-end, making a long, fluorescent-lit tunnel. The soldiers in camp nicknamed the place the Snake. It was filled with the latest space-age gear, satellite communications, computers, display screens, miles of wire, and hundreds of blinking lights. All of this was powered by tall banks of diesel-run generators that roared day and night throughout the camp. The Jock sat next to an aircraft taxiway and the concrete bunkers used as living quarters by the 160th SOAR pilots, even grimmer accommodations indeed, to Spencer's mind, than his own team's. The concrete Quonsets had been used by the Soviets as aircraft hangars during their 1979 invasion of Afghanistan, and they had sloping, bell-curved roofs, which the men, pilots and soldiers alike, used as a makeshift gym. By loading their rucksacks with 60 pounds of rock and strapping them on, they could hike up and down the slope of the roofs until their leg muscles screamed for rest. They made dumbbells out of 5-gallon plastic buckets of water balanced on each end of a broomstick, and pulled off countless reps in between mission planning sessions. When they weren't lifting the buckets, they were using them once a week to shower with. The buckets were painted black, and by setting them in the sun, the water inside would heat ever so slightly. They fashioned a hose to run off the bucket that delivered a thin, tepid stream down on their filthy heads. The common latrine was a dark, deep hole in the middle of a barren field, over which you squatted en plein air, unadorned by screening trees or even a scrap lumber wall. When Night Stalker Mission Commander John Garfield had landed at K2 and stepped off the airplane, the first thing he saw was a soldier squatting in the field and casually reading a magazine. "I'm in the Stone Age now," he thought. "Just one click away from clubbing your own meat for dinner." The pre-flight briefing, which had taken place earlier that morning, had been about as freewheeling as Essex had ever seen. Mulholland got right to the point. Their mission: link up with the warlord General Rashid Dostum at a village called Dehi. Three CIA officers had arrived there the week before to prepare the way by familiarizing themselves with the warlord's capabilities and intel network. If they survived this, they were to capture the city of Mazar-e Sharif, about 60 miles north of Delhi. How they accomplished any of this was up to them. "Trust no one," warned Mulholland. "Not Dostum, not any Afghan. No one in this country is clean," he said. Nelson had next stood up in the cramped tent and launched into their mission plan. Gaunt, bow-legged, with short blonde hair, Nelson spoke in a high, reedy voice and looked very much like a windswept son of the American High Plains, which he was. "Sir," he began, "we are going to win." He had drawn arrows with a red Sharpie pen on a wide roll of paper fed through an easel, marking the team's sure, solid advance. The arrows bulldozed through miles of sand, scree, rock, pomegranate, blue chicory and sweet acacia, pine tree and poplar, over riverbeds, up cliffsides, across forlorn twilight plateaus, and kept pushing for the horizon, where at night the stars would come up out of the singed cauldron of the autumn night and wheel overhead and smear the sky with ancient phosphorescence. The briefing took about 5 minutes. When it was over, Mulholland looked at all of them. He was deeply moved by their earnestness, their belief that they could win. He really didn't know what would happen to them. He really didn't know if they would be killed as soon as they landed. This mission, this war, had the air of a lark, a deadly one. It all sounded so simple on paper, as Nelson explained it, but they all knew the first rule, that the plans for war were the first things to be thrown out once the war started. From that moment, you lived minute by minute. "You guys got the job," said Mulholland. "Good luck." It had been a long day for the hard-as-nails 46-year-old Mulholland. Towering at 6'5", with hands large as oven mitts, he was not a man easily cowed. But Mulholland had been on the phone for most of the morning, getting his ass chewed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. "Why in the hell aren't there American soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan?" the SecDef had asked. "The weather," was all Mulholland could say, deeply exasperated. And this was true. The weather was spooky, something right out of a child's dark fairy tale. For the past 3 nights, Mulholland had been trying to put Essex, Spencer, Nelson, and the rest of the team into Dostum's camp, about 250 miles to the south of K2. But the helicopters had been blown back by freak sand and snowstorms that hadn't shown up in any of the U.S. Army's weather forecasts. The Night Stalker pilots ferrying the guys over the mountains were tearing their hair. On the first night's attempt, they had returned to base after 9 hours of flying in total whiteout, unable to discern any difference between the ground and sky. They made a name up for this, flying into the ping-pong ball. Afterward, the 160th Night Stalker pilots walked back from the flight line to the dank, bat-infested Quonset bunker they called home, completely white-faced. They sat on their cots and stared at the floor, like terrified mimes. "You couldn't have shoved a hot buttered pin up my ass," said one of them, the otherwise surly and battle-hardened Greg Gibson, who just weeks earlier had been driving his Jeep to work at Night Stalker headquarters when he heard the news of the attacks in New York. Back then, he thought he was the man for the job. A veteran of the world's worst wars for the past 30 years, he had been ready to kick some Al-Qaeda ass. Now he was finding this flying over Afghanistan's mountains the scariest flying he'd ever done. And that was the problem. The mountains. They soared from what seemed the loneliest-looking valley floor on the face of the earth, a place that more resembled the bottom of a drained ocean at the end of time, straight up to 16,000, 18,000, 20,000 feet, draped in frozen garlands of snow. Back home, the highest Gibson and the guys usually flew in the Chinook, the special operations workhorse of a helicopter, was around 3,000 feet, in Colorado, on training missions. On the occasion they hit 10,000 feet, they felt like they'd flown to the top of the world. In Afghanistan, low altitude started at 10,000 feet. Gibson and his men were literally flying their helicopters into no man's sky. Nobody, and he meant nobody, in the history of U.S. Army aviation, had ever flown a helicopter this high, this far. And they were trying to do it at night. But that wasn't the part that bothered them. Flying blacked out, as they called it, with no lights on inside the aircraft or on the exterior, and using state-of-the-art avionics, was done for security's sake. These pilots feared daylight flights the way vampires fear a noon sun. Hard to see, harder to hit. The night stalkers own the night. The problem was that they couldn't get the goddamn weather forecast right. On the second night, they returned to base equally demoralized and freaked out by their inability to punch through the cloud layer. It just wouldn't quit. There was no cloud layer. It was all a white fuzz. And Gibson, along with his mission commander, John Garfield, practically grabbed the poor weatherman by the ear and dragged him to the Night Stalker's bunker. "All right," said Garfield, a normally affable fellow, a former Delta soldier with over 300 combat jumps to his name. "Tell us what we're finding up there at 10,000 feet. If we run into it again, we're taking you up with us." The weatherman hurried back to his table of charts, graphs, and computer models, and started rethinking the problem. And the problem was that he was relying too much on technology. When he broke the satellite photos out of their video display and examined each image individually, he discovered something that shocked him. Hidden, except in this static view, was a mass of sand, snow, and God knew what else. Amazingly, the blob measured hundreds of miles across and materialized not from the ground up, but in midair at around 10,000 feet. And it was completely undetectable except under the naked eye, after thorough and anxious study. He gave this freakish weather formation a new name, the Black Stratus. Now, on the third night, as the Night Stalkers prepared for liftoff, they were ready for the Black Stratus. Just knowing what this thing was comforted them. Essex settled into one of the Chinook's web seats in the back, on the right. There was just enough room for his legs if he sat with them bent to his chest, hiking boots touching the gear in the middle. Beside him was his rucksack, his new home away from home, for what he figured would be a year's trip into the void, fighting and shooting, killing strangers and making new friends. His tan shirt pockets were stuffed with the fussy lanyap of a neatnik, one of the Garmin GPSs that the guys back at Fort Campbell had FedExed to him at the last minute, 5 unsharpened pencils, a writing notebook that could double as a journal, reference cards called TA, Tactical Air Cards, with directions on how to call in close air support, calculate distances, recon ambush sites, and fire mortars, dog tags, a couple of $100 in American currency, and something called a blood chit, which was a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card, to be presented to any Afghans he met, should he be trapped behind enemy lines and need assistance. Essex drolly reflected that there would be little time in his journey during which he would not be behind enemy lines, seeing that he was a guerrilla fighter and all. The Blood Chit offered a cash reward to anyone who gave assistance to the American soldier in distress. In his rucksack, he carried ammo for his long rifle, the M4 carbine, clothes, and enough food for 5 days. 1 meal's ready to eat, MRE, a day, plus purification tablets for drinking water. His mesh, many-pocketed load-bearing vest resembled in cut and style a fly fisherman's. Only Essex's was filled with grenades, more ammo for his 9mm pistol, compass, water bottle, an emergency MRE, and batteries for an inter-team handheld radio. On top of his rucksack, in its own duffel, sat the gift of vodka for his warlord-to-be, General Dostum. Because he fully expected to be killed in the first 5 minutes after he hit the ground, he kept busy alongside Spencer, helping the rest of the team load its gear. "There's nothing I can do now," he reasoned. "I'm just a chunk of cargo. If something goes bad, I'll just have to deal with it then." He watched as the guys marched up the ramp and slung their heavy rucksacks on the pile in the center of the deck. Captain Nelson was squeezed in his seat up front, on the left side, behind lead pilot Alex McGee. Nelson was already wired into the ship's headphones, pulled down over his ears atop his black cap, nervously listening to the crosstalk and chatter between McGee and his co-pilot, Jim Zealand, going through their pre-flight checks. Sitting next to him, imperious and wry, was Sam Diller, the senior intel officer on the team, and at 40, the oldest. Earlier in the day, he had been sitting in his tent drinking coffee when a staff officer poked his head inside and said, "Hey, it's going down tonight. The weather is fair, and you're going." They'd loaded their gear onto a truck and rode the quarter mile out to the helo, plopped it down on the ground, and waited. The air crew had come out about the same time as they did. Diller was wedged in his seat next to his buddy, the jovial, bearded senior medic, Bill Bennett. He and Bennett had been on the team in 1991 to help oust Saddam from Kuwait, and Bennett had rejoined the crew several days after September 11. Back home, Bennett, a quiet, handsome, unassuming 33-year-old with 15 years of service, had a wife and teenage son with whom he liked to kayak and hike on the weekends in the Tennessee foothills. But all that was now a million miles away. Like most everybody on the team, Bennett spoke Arabic and had been trained in the art of sniper fire, mortar launch, and high-altitude parachute jumps from 25,000 feet, during which he would breathe from a mini-tank of oxygen strapped to his arm. He and Diller were keeping an eye on an eager group of younger gunfighters, average age 32, each with about 8 years in SF. "This is your first rodeo," Diller had told junior weapon specialist Sean Coffers, who had joined the unit from the 101st Airborne. "You're sticking with me." Nearly everybody was married and had children. There were more than a few broken marriages in the rearview mirror. Sitting next to Bennett was Vern Michaels, the good-humored senior communications officer, and junior engineer Patrick Remington. These six guys were the A-team, the alpha cell of the 12-man detachment. On the other side of the aircraft, the right side, Chief Warrant Officer Cal Spencer was running herd on the six-man Bravo cell. Spencer was sitting near the ramp, next to Pat Essex, his co-leader. Crammed in beside them were junior engineer Charles Jones and weapon specialist Ben Milo, a burly, affable, 30-year-old weapon sergeant from the suburbs of Chicago. Milo was usually the motor mouth of the team, the one guy they always had to keep away from the press. Not that the press ever came around, but still they worried. But now Milo was sitting there in his tiny web seat, not saying anything. and Spencer was trying to think of something to say, some joke to crack, to perk him up. Milo was a devout Catholic, an amateur artist. He loved drawing 1970s vintage record album covers, like those of Pink Floyd and the Grateful Dead, whose beefy appearance disguised the restless, high-speed spirit of an overachiever. Several weeks earlier, the announcement that he would be deploying on this mission had gone off like a bomb in his family, and caused Milo's wife, Carla, to start crying. The mother of four, including two teenagers, and herself a nursing student at night school, Carla had not been prepared for Ben's departure. They went to their youngest son's grade school to pick him up and spend time with him before his father left. Ben was angry. He wanted to kill those involved with his bare hands. He couldn't understand why they had hurt civilians on American soil. If they'd hit a military target, he felt he could have grasped the reasoning. A few days before leaving, Milo was driving with a friend, another weapons sergeant on the team, and finally lost his temper. "They pissed me off and they pissed my wife off," he started yelling. He ranted so long about the jihadis and what he was going to do to them that his teammate had to pull over and stop laughing before driving on. "Oh, I'm serious now," Ben was muttering. "Those motherfuckers are going to feel my pain, 'cause I'm one pissed person. Oh, I'm very serious now." But sitting in the helo, he was wondering what it would mean, what it would feel like to kill a man. What would his priest back home think? He figured he hadn't the slightest idea. But he did know that he'd just have to keep pulling the trigger when he got in a fight. Milo crossed himself and prepared for liftoff. Next to Milo was Scott Black, who as a junior medic was more worried about saving lives than ending them. The intel he'd gotten on General Dostum was that the warlord was overweight, a heavy drinker, hence the housewarming gift of vodka, that he had diabetes and didn't have use of his right arm, that he tired easy and his eyesight was failing, that the ruthless codger was a footstep from the grave. This man, this raconteur, this bon vivant, a former plumber and peasant son, would be Black's new best friend, and clearly he was a walking medical emergency. It was Black's thankless job to make sure the weakened 47-year-old Uzbeki didn't die on his watch. How embarrassing would that be? Black figured Dostum's own militia would probably try to kill him if Dostum died under his care. Black was ready to hit the ground and begin CPR on the guy immediately. Sitting next to Black was the team's comedian, a tall, gangly soul named Fred Falls, a junior commo officer. Like Spencer, Falls delighted in dry, corny humor. The previous night, the two of them had sat in their tent, watching the 1985 Chevy Chase Dan Aykroyd movie, Spies Like Us, using a laptop propped open on a table made from sawhorses. A screwball comedy about two hapless Americans who get lost in Afghanistan and are captured by Mujahideen fighters. At one point, Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd are strung up by their ankles, ready to be tortured, and they try cajoling their captors into letting them go. Spencer and Falls thought the movie was hysterical, while the rest of the team just rolled their eyes. In reality, everyone had already decided that they would not be taken alive if a gun battle came to that. They'd sat in their cots and written what they called their death letters, last missives home to wives and family, about last thoughts. One Special Forces soldier had poured his heart out. He truly expected not to come home at all. "If you are reading this letter," he wrote to his family, "things are not well for me. And I had so many things I wanted to do with you both. I love you and think of you as often as possible. You made me the happiest man in the world. He had told his fellow soldiers, Look, we're in this together. And we need to know that coming back isn't really an option for us. If we get killed in the process, we get killed. I don't want us to shy away from what we have to do. After writing their letters, the men removed wedding rings and emptied wallets of any possibly incriminating photos of family and friends, images and information that could be used against them in a torture session, and dropped these tokens of identity in large manila envelopes provided for the occasion. These were sealed and handed for safekeeping to the chaplain. On Nelson's team, the Bravo cell's job in Afghanistan would be supporting the Alpha cell by running the log train, short for logistics, which meant making sure that everybody had enough beans, bullets, and blankets to fight another day. This job was not as glamorous as being on the A-team, but the distinction went unspoken here. As Spencer reminded everyone, there were no small jobs in the business of war, just dead egomaniacs. Tonight they were going in single ship. This meant that the entire group was flying into Afghanistan on one helicopter. Usually, half the 12-man team flew on one bird, while the other half followed behind on a second. This way, if either one of the helicopters was shot down, the entire group would not be wiped out. Within Special Forces doctrine, the team was to resemble an amoeba, dividing and thriving in even the most austere environments. This was why the group had two of everything. Two medics, Bennett and Black, two COMO officers, Michaels and Falls, whose job it was to run the radios and communications within the team and with headquarters back at K2, and two weapon specialists, Coffers and Milo, tasked with the mind-boggling challenge of memorizing weapons and ammo used around the world and training the teams in their use. Engineers Pat Essex and Charles Jones kept the teams supplied, organized, and operating swiftly like a mini-corporation whose business was handcrafted violence. Sam Diller, as the intel chief, was point man for information flowing among the CIA, the Pentagon, or headquarters in K2, and the two teams. The leanest level Nelson had taken the group to in training was three guys to a cell. This meant that from an organism of 12 guys, he could split the team into four pieces. "We train like the terrorists do," Nelson was always reminding everybody. "We fight like terrorists." Sam Diller believed that each SF trooper ought to be able to shoot all the bad guys, bomb them, know how to use the radio to report what happened, and do the necessary medical care afterward. You know, Diller liked to say, the whole man concept. In his shirt pocket, alongside his toothbrush, Diller carried a dog-eared edition of the poet and warrior Sun Tzu's favorite aphorisms. Diller had memorized many of them and quoted at will in his West Virginia drawl. "When on offense, strike like lightning from the clouds. All war is deception." Diller further liked to paraphrase Steve McQueen in The Magnificent Seven when describing the team's esprit de corps. "Mister, we deal in lead." Diller was traveling so light that he had even cut down his pencils to 3 inches each to shave off ounces. He carried a pair of heavy-duty mittens bought at Walmart in a back pants pocket. He was lean, broad-shouldered, with a face like carved oak. He had come a long way from the battered house trailer on the West Virginia hillside that he'd shared with Lisa, his wife, before joining the Army in 1986. Diller had played football in college and gotten a degree to become a history teacher. He loved teaching, and he loved working with kids. He was a study in contrasts, with his high holler voice and quick mind. He spoke deliberately, slow and methodical as lug nuts dropping in an oil pan. He was a man of few outside interests, except gun collecting. He'd spent at least half his life sleeping outdoors as a soldier, yet he hated camping. He kept his own counsel. During Desert Storm, his sergeant had asked him to maintain the team's diary, a daily record of events. At the end of a month, Diller had written one terse sentence. "We trained, it was hot, and I got sick." His sergeant told him to quit keeping the diary. But Diller was crazy like a fox. His father had been the editor of a West Virginia daily newspaper, and an aficionado of musical theater. An erudite man who wore bow ties and loved his rough son unconditionally. Diller was headed for a career in academia when one night, shortly after getting his degree, his life took an unexpected turn. He was at a bar, and he got into a fight, a bad one, which is to say the other guy, the poor, unlucky son of a bitch, didn't win. Even as the cops were hauling him away, Diller realized his teaching career was finished before it began. He pled to a misdemeanor and was sentenced to 3 years probation. "Schools don't hire teachers who tend to wrap other guys around their fist," he realized. He and Lisa moved into the trailer up on the hillside, crowded around by kudzu, chickens, and car parts, and Sam got the only job he could find, mixing cement for a construction company, 12 hours a day. It was back-breaking, god-awful work. But there was a part of Diller that felt he deserved this as penance. He had a brother who was in the army, and one weekend the man came to visit Diller while he was on leave. His brother told him that he was actually getting paid to be on vacation. Diller couldn't believe it. He'd never thought of joining the army. Within a matter of weeks, he'd enlisted. He and Lisa left the house trailer and never looked back. He went to work in the 2nd Cavalry Division as a scout, a man trained to sneak into enemy lines as an observer. And then another unexpected thing happened. Diller got bored. The army had so many rules and regulations, it seemed no one could find their own ass with both hands unless somebody told them how. He grew miserable. He brooded. He spoke even less, which heretofore hadn't seemed possible. Lisa could barely stand to be around him. One day he met a Special Forces soldier who told him, "Man, you'll dig what I'm doing. It's everything you want." Diller said, "Tell me more." He was a voracious reader, and he already knew enough about the history of warfare that he figured he might like being a guerrilla fighter. He liked the odds of being outnumbered, outgunned. He liked the idea of fighting for his life with his back against a wall. He liked being able to think for himself. Within a matter of weeks, he had signed up for Special Forces selection. When the 2 years of training were over, when he was handed his green beret on graduation and could proudly call himself a Special Forces soldier, he discovered that he felt more likable in the SF. He had been sure Lisa was going to divorce him. Now he wasn't so sure. Diller chalked up this life change to something he called the big boy rules. The rules were hard to define, harder to embody, even harder to follow. But they went like this. When you followed the rules, you agreed to do what you said you were going to do. No questions asked, no excuses given. You agreed to pay for your own mistakes. When you lived by the rules, though, every man was working for himself, and every man was devoted to the brother on his left and right. The rules were righteous, they were real, and they seemed to resemble how the universe really worked. Diller grasped them immediately. Take the way he helped train the younger guys in the team. Diller always led the way. Every dawn, he pushed them through a 4-mile run, followed by enough sit-ups and push-ups to make an Olympian god throw up. And then after that came 30 minutes of hand-to-hand combat training, based on the street-fighting techniques of the famed Gracie brothers, the Brazilian brawlers who'd gained notoriety in the 1990s for their bloody Ultimate Fighter matches on pay-per-view cable TV. The Special Forces soldiers called this mode of fighting grappling. It was meant to disable and do great bodily harm with an economy of movement. Eye gouging, groin stomping, arm breaking, and choking were the order of the day. In training, you could tap out when the pain got too great, or when you felt yourself slipping into unconsciousness as your buddy gripped your windpipe. Grappling was what you did when you were out of bullets at last, and you'd even thrown the gun itself at your attacker, before diving in and tearing him to bits. It was mean, vicious work, and it made you into a walking human demolition team. Diller excelled. He believed that the everyday SF soldier could survive circumstances that would fry the circuitry of normal men. He was treated like a pro, and he trained like one too. And he did this away from the limelight of reporters and politicians. He got paid decent money, about $4,000 a month for a 15-year veteran, to take on the worst of the bad guys, and to train the lamest guys on the planet to be soldiers. He was proud of saying, "We ain't got hero stamped on us. None of us does." Going in single ship tonight was risky. But because Colonel Mulholland had been on the phone all day with Rumsfeld, he felt it was a risk he had to take. Simultaneously, he was launching another team in the east of the country, and this had left him with only one helicopter with which to deliver Nelson's team to the United States primary initiative in the south. Diller oddly saw this bold chance-taking by Mulholland as evidence of the old man's chutzpah. If they were shot down, Diller figured he could fight his way out of the jam, living in the weeds, surviving. But Mulholland? He'd be tarred and feathered. His career possibly might end. The Chinook rocked and shifted on its 4 balloon tires. The blunt nose dipped, and the entire length of the craft swung in the air and rose. At the helicopter landing zone in the Darya Suf River Valley, 250 miles to the south, Ali Sarwar awaited the arrival of Diller and his team. He didn't know these men, but he was hanging his future on them. He closed his eyes and strained to hear the approaching clatter of the huge American machine. Nothing. Not yet. Patience. For most of his life, all he had known was war. He had fought back with Massoud, whom he knew as the greatest warrior of the 20th century, and with Dostum, the opportunist. Ali Sarwar was now a lieutenant in his tribe's army, the Hazaras, under General Mohakek's command. Fair-skinned and green-eyed, his head wrapped in a green scarf, Ali stood at the landing zone with a dozen other men, all eager as he to attack the Taliban. He was portly, dressed in billowing linen pants and heavy oiled boots. On his left shoulder he carried a leather bullet box he had taken from a Chechen he'd killed a week earlier in the fierce fighting at Safid Kota. He was tired, hungry, and nearly out of bullets for his battered AK-47 after the month-long battle. He lit a cigarette and exhaled slowly at the sky. His father had been a shopkeeper and provided well for his family. Ali was a good student in school. But as a teenager, his house had been under siege, first by the Soviets, and then by factions of Afghan soldiers fighting for control of the city. walking to school. The mornings were often traced by the crack of interlocking lines of gunfire. All of the men and boys in his neighborhood eventually picked up guns to protect their homes and families. Ali was shot in the foot and hit by bomb shrapnel in the leg, causing him to limp in cold weather. Always the Taliban had more bullets, more jet fighters, more men. He shifted nervously in the gray talc of the landing zone and hoped those odds were finally changing. He looked over at the secretive CIA men, Baba Span, Baba Olson, and the elder gray-bearded Baba JJ, whose grizzled beard was a sign of wisdom in Ali's culture. He wondered why the other Americans didn't have full hair on their own faces. He figured it was not their way. He didn't care. He was not a fanatic. He liked to smoke. He liked to drink. He only had one wife, even though the Quran told him he could have four. But what kind of man even could have time and patience for four wives? No. One woman was enough for Ali Sarwar. Ali and his men had swept the area, but it was impossible to say if they were safe in this stony silence. Who knew if Taliban were lurking in the rocks and cliffs surrounding them? The moon hung overhead, a bleached horn driven into the flank of the night. Ali could hear the gentle pattering of the horses' hooves in the damp mud of the evening, and the burble of men talking quietly in Dari. Everyone was straining to hear the approach of the American machine. One of the men, Baba Span, his tight, angular face smudged by a sketchy shadow of beard, walked out to the edge of the landing pad, about as big as an American baseball field. Ali had seen pictures on TV, the Yankees of New York playing under bright lights. And the wiry American set something small, about the size of a deck of cards, on the dirt. Ali waited for the object to do something, but he saw nothing. It just sat there. He figured it was a gadget whose use he would understand in the future, when the future came. He watched as Baba Span flipped down heavy rubber glasses over his eyes and stared at the gadget. He seemed to nod, pleased, and then he flipped the glasses back. Ali knew the glasses helped men see at night, which seemed another fantastic thing he did not understand about the Americans. He did understand that the men arriving by helicopter would help him win this war against the Taliban. He hated the Taliban with every drop of his blood. When the Taliban captured Mazar-i-Sharif in 1998, Ali had sent his family, his wife, two sons, and three daughters, to the Central Highlands, to Bamiyan, the homeland of the Hazaras, for safekeeping. Ali was horrified and enraged when in March of 2001, the Taliban dynamited the stone Buddhas that had stood watch over the town for centuries. What man had the right to write the future by blowing up the past? With his family in Bamiyan, Ali remained behind in Mazar-i-Sharif to fight. The city was littered with bodies. The Taliban cut the heads off prisoners and set them on pikes along the streets. Ali was a wanted man. The Taliban announced that if anyone could capture Ali Sarwar, they would set free one Northern Alliance prisoner. Someone, some poor, unlucky man, thought Ali, was snatched up by the villagers and turned in as the criminal Ali Sarwar. The Taliban released a prisoner and then tortured the man they supposed to be Ali. They cut off his head and put it in his lap and set him by the side of the road so he could stare at the 10,000 ankles of men, women, and children sleepwalking through the filth and nightmare of their lives. That was how Ali Sarwar came to be standing at the landing zone, waiting for the American bird to roar in. At liftoff, Captain Mitch Nelson was thinking, "You could fight your heart out and still lose. That sunk in from Mitch. That really got to him. He steeled himself against the coming blast of cold air as the helo corkscrewed up into the night sky. 1,000 feet, 2,000, 4,000, 5. It was the most amazing thing, the most amazing feeling. Flying into battle was all Mitch Nelson, from Kansas, had ever dreamed about back on the open range amid the winter wheat, sorghum, and vetch. He had ridden bulls in college on the amateur rodeo circuit. He had stared down bodily harm. But this bucking helicopter ride, even higher now, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, was a new thing. It completed Mitch. Made him new. The stench of aviation fuel in the cockpit was overpowering, like burnt caramel. Facing the pilots, he was lined up on the left side as the long rotors overhead went to work against the frozen air. Wham, thrum, wham, thrum, wham. Nearby sat Ben Milo, who was now stone-cold quiet, brooding. And there was Spencer, with his long shafts of pine-straight legs folded up beneath him. Spencer in his black polyester jacket, with the collar shot up, and his black watch cap pulled down over his ears. The very picture of cool. Nelson knew that Spencer, Essex, and Diller were keeping an eye on him. He knew he had to walk sharp. He was the captain of the team, it was true. But these three, pushing 40 and beyond, were damn near senior citizens. Freaking old. Yet they walked tall. Nelson was going to have to hit one out of the park as the team's leader. He was confident he could do this. Nelson believed there should be two kinds of soldiers. The kind you saw on television news, and the kind you didn't see. Nelson was the man you didn't see. The Taliban's goal was to lay waste to them, make them suffer, make them gut it out through a long, painful winter, and then attack them in the spring. Time and shitty weather were on the Taliban's side, and the only thing Mitch Nelson had was the backing of the entire U.S. Army. And that was a scary thing, to have all that American might at your back. Yet if you died, if you got killed, captured, tortured, no one would ever know you had been here. Except the people back in Kansas, standing around the rodeo ring in the twilight, saying between their teeth, "Remember that Nelson kid? Huh? What happened to him? Got killed, I guess." And so on. Until no one remembered that you had been living aboard this very helicopter at this very minute, with this hard wind freezing like enamel at the back of your throat, with the rear ramp down and the snow blowing in, and the side doors open and the wind clawing at the helo's quilted walls, as you sat there shivering and leaning forward on your M4 rifle, while the metal barrel, about as slim as a pool cue, turned to ice in your gloved hands. Nelson looked around. These 12 guys in this helicopter comprised the entire American fighting force striking back at Osama bin Laden. It was just them, he realized. Them alone. It was enough to make you want to crawl under the poncho liner until the crosshairs of history had passed you by. Nelson strained forward to see out the helicopter's windscreen. Piercing reefs of black rock loomed out of the night and passed below the broad, frog-like belly of the craft. And then, as if shooting over shoal water into the deep, the earth dropped away, and there was nothing but darkness. A chasm so black, it snapped into focus under Nelson as the essence of eternity. It was one of the most exciting things that had ever happened to him. Flying east toward Tajikistan, they were passing over a mountain the pilots had told him they'd nicknamed the Bear. As they rose, 9,000, 10,000, 11,000, the temperature plummeted. The ship's heaters weren't cranking for security reasons. Back at K2, Mission Commander John Garfield had decided that if the pilots ran the heaters, this would change the thermal signature of the aircraft. This meant that if they were attacked by a heat-seeking missile, the warhead would lock onto the cockpit and kill the pilots, instead of going after the two turbine engines, which were mounted up and aft of the cockpit. Either way, Garfield pointed out, life would suck. But at least if they survived the initial strike, there might be the chance that someone still alive could crash-land the aircraft. The doors were open, so that the pilots and soldiers could exit in just such an emergency, without fumbling with latches and handles. The rear ramp hung down in the night, a ribbed metal tongue measuring about 15 feet long. As they climbed, Spencer watched Frost spider over the exposed metal in the craft, across the deck and up the walls. He threw his poncho liner over his head, trying to keep warm. He thought, I'm the old guy here. The young ones are looking to me. Am I doing anything weird? Anything that would break their confidence? He threw the poncho off. Shredded bits of snow and microgrit swirled in the air. The cabin howled. The cold air hit him immediately. He figured it was time to... Jesus, mother, Crisco oil, it's cold in this helicopter. He figured it was time to crack a joke. It is so freaking cold in this goddamned helicopter. And try to lighten everybody's mood, especially Milo's. Spencer called out. Hey, Milo.
Yes, sir.
It's chilly in here.
What's that, sir?
I said it's pretty goddamn chilly. Milo looked at him like he was crazy.
Fucking A, sir. You got that right.
And then Milo closed his eyes and tried to go to sleep. Ice grew on the barrels of the machine guns mounted in the doors. The army bastard standing in the doors manning the guns, Spencer didn't know their names, stood still as ceramic gnomes, bundled in layers of parkas, snow pants, gloves, and heavy boots, their helmeted heads bobbling back and forth as they scanned the far, far distant ground for muzzle flashes, missile fires. They knew that a Stinger missile lifted off the ground sparkly and twirling. Rockets flew up like the lit end of a glowing cigarette in somebody's hand as they lifted. It was a hell of a ride. One of those guys manning the guns was Flight Engineer Carson Milhouse, a 10-year career man from Southern California. With his straight black hair and old-timey gold-rimmed spectacles, Milhouse looked like someone you'd see on the back of a Lynyrd Skynyrd album. The pilots had nicknamed him Hippie. Growing up in a family of 8 kids, he'd spent his youth despising the military. And then it dawned on him that the easiest way out of the house was to join the army. Hippie loved the men he worked with, and he lived in fear of being promoted out of the unit. If he went up in rank to Master Sergeant, he was a Sergeant First Class, he'd find that there were fewer slots available, and he'd have to leave and enter the regular army, where his new pay grade would make life more comfortable, but where the daytime flying and regular routine would bore him to death. This was a terrible thought. Now, after about an hour of flying, Hippie could barely move his arms. His gloved hands, clenched on the gun handles, felt like they'd hardened in that position. As he looked down at the countryside, he wondered how in hell anybody ever managed to live in this country. Just rows of mud houses and mud fences. Not one damn light burning on the face of the earth. Midnight in Armageddon. It sure sucked being here in Afghanistan, he thought. But at least he didn't have to get off the helo like the soldiers in back and fight in this terrain. Hippie didn't know any of their names, but he guessed he'd probably bumped into some of them on Friday nights with their families back home, going into a Chili's or the Outback Steakhouse on Exit 4 off the interstate. He wished them well,
and hunkered down in his parka, scanning the ground for gunfire. The other soldiers on Spencer's team were looking at him nervously, and for a second time he made a show of fluffing up his poncho liner and getting comfy atop the frozen nylon ribs of his seat and going to sleep. Spencer figured it'd take them about 2 or more hours to fly the several hundred miles to Dahe. Essex was already asleep. He could sleep through anything. Diller, too, was passed out, snoring. Spencer figured racking out for shut-eye was the only sensible thing to do. He lay out in the seat, listening as the rotors overhead bit into ever-thinning air, and the aircraft strained upward with a terrible clatter. From his seat up front, Nelson looked down and saw why the pilots had named the mountain the Bear. Below him was an eye, what looked like a deep, cold lake, winking at him. The broad, stony snout was lifted west into the wind. The high, steep forehead was sloping down from the north. Nelson said it again. The Bear. Amen. Up in the cockpit, lead pilot Alex McGee was straining at the controls as they entered, or he feared they were entering, the hypoxic zone. Going hypoxic was a possibility when you entered airspace above 9,000 feet, and your brain started screaming for oxygen. The effect was like shotgunning champagne and hitting yourself in the head with a ball-peen hammer. Only the results could be a lot more dangerous. The Night Stalker pilots had been going hypoxic regularly, on early missions ferrying supplies and CIA officers to General Dostum's camp. It had become a routine part of flying. The term in use was that lately the missions had become awfully sporty. As in, sporty means you come back to base, and you get off the ramp, and you kiss the ground for a while. You just take off your helmet and stare. Phew, that's sporty. The pilots were a hale and hearty lot. Instead of growing glum, thinking that they would be killed on these missions, they became world-class goofs. One of the crew chiefs, a 36-year-old fellow named Will Ferguson, had brought his golf clubs along, a sand wedge, an 8-iron, and a 3-iron, and a gym bag of balls. One night, bored out of his mind after having watched Joe Dirt one too many times back at the hangar, the unit's favorite after-hours flick, Will had gone out to the berm lining the camp and stood in the moonlight and surveyed the wasteland. Piles of toxic dirt, oozing chemical waste. Pine trees gently swaying in the breeze. Will set the ball on the berm, ready to send it into the gloom on the other side, where supposedly Islamic militants were lurking, sniper rifles in hand. To hell with them, thought Will. He fired. The ball soared, a white orb sinking in the dirty pond of the night sky. Well, I came, I fought, I golfed. Then he slid the club back down in the bag and returned to the Quonset. The pilots' quirky sense of humor was second only to their regard for the danger of their missions, especially when it came to going hypoxic. The problem was with the oxygen system on board the Chinook. It was in need of repairs, but the war had spun up so quickly that there hadn't been time to make them. The crew had landed at K2 on October 6, with the Chinooks and Black Hawk helicopters broken down neatly inside the dimly lit belly of the C-17 transport planes, and they'd had just 48 hours to reassemble them. One Army observer described this chaotic, anxious task as resembling ants attacking a Twinkie. No one had slept on the journey overseas, and when they finished tightening the last bolt and nut, they literally passed out on the oil-stained concrete next to the newly born behemoths. By then, they'd not slept in a week. Garfield walked into the hangar and barked, "Wake up! We have a mission to do!" Within 8 hours,
They were ferrying supplies and CIA officers into scattered camps around the country, in preparation for the arrival of Nelson and his team. The onboard breathing system was made up of a series of oxygen bottles, feeding a series of tubes leading to the kind of black rubber breathing masks